That whole thing seems to be because lesser potential and having mundane hope and fear and then being a spiritual meditator to become free from that is almost seen like a negative thing. That's the bad thing to do. From a very much the profound teachings and the Dhamma's perspective, then we can say, yes, it is not a good thing to do because you're capable of doing better. But it never says that it is a bad thing to do which you must conceal and suppress so that you begin to pretend something that you're not capable of at this moment. And so spirituality must come out of becoming a clique, a club, that you have to have certain credentials and qualifications to become members of, but must go down to the basics of dealing with humanness and human hope and fear and human wishes, aspirations, securities and insecurities. And since we've come to a point where this is not openly done, you have no other choice but to work with your own self, realize your own responsibility to your own self. Being a person who says, I have this hope, and I'm a practitioner hoping for this, and I am a practitioner and meditating to be free from this fear, and being very realistic and true to yourself and making your practice such that it becomes something that can give you the fruition of that hope and aspiration is a very good way to meditate. Tibetan, those who have begun to practice Tibetan Buddhism and the lineage of Tibetan Buddhism, the Sakya Kagyu Nyingma Gelug, all of us often have the bad habit of sort of looking. Even 1987, when I first came to the Bay Area in Seattle at that time, I had the opportunity of working with Jodo Shinshu and the Nichiren traditions of Japanese Buddhism at that time. And I remember coming in with a kind of, it's the Tibetan Buddhist mentality these days, I call that, is where you think, oh, we are talking about bodhicitta and enlightenment, non-duality, Tathagata Garbha, Sugata Garbha, Buddha nature, and so forth. And then working with some people who were, for example, the Amitabha Pure Land Buddhists. If you look at them, they're very, very sort of genuine in their aspirations. May I have long life, may I live long, may I be free from sicknesses and health and so forth. And we meditate and we think, oh, they're so relative, isn't it? They're so basic. As a meditator, you should be thinking about everything is emptiness in nature and this is shunyata and absolute primordial is the primordially enlightened nature of your own inherent heart and so on and so forth. But in doing so, if you're capable of remaining really untouched by the relativities of hope and fear, that's very fine. There's no arguing about that. But then there's also the hidden insecurities of your mind that you have to be very true to. And when you're not true to that, this very strong discrepancy within your own, the struggle comes in, where you want to do something, you cannot, and what you really want to work with, you're not able to be true to that. And so the conflict happens where you then begin to find in the Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist meditation, you will find the conflict of never being able to understand non-duality. If you're relative and you're true to the relative appearances and relative hopes and fear, you always will feel guilty because there's always that pressure in your mind that will say, no, but you're not supposed to have attachment. You're supposed to be beyond ego grasping. You're supposed to look at the true nature of emptiness. You are not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to do this. Look at the way we have conversations with one another. I've joked about this so many times, I'm sure I'm repeating myself. But I've always said, I do not like to socialize with Buddhists. That's my personal thing. I can come to a Dharma center and I will always be there to give the talk that I'm required to give. But apart from that, you'll never find me unless it's a situation I cannot avoid. And that's because you cannot talk normal. who I am, for example, the name that I carry and my teachers, whatever I've learned from my teachers, they come and they expect things to be... You cannot say something like, it's a nice cup of coffee. They'll immediately say, but Rinpoche, you're supposed to look at the non-dual nature of the coffee, isn't it? But that coffee is relative. You have to say something very profound. You cannot say something like, this is a nice blue sky. It has to be Dhammakaya's profound blue pancake. And so where the conversation itself becomes so fabricated, so very pretentious, then it comes to a point where it influences your life. And so relativity, you cannot be really true to the relativity because you're forced to always look at the absolute nature. Absolute nature of impermanence, absolute nature of emptiness, absolute nature of non-duality, luminosity, dhammakaya, dhammadhatu, and so on and so forth. Then you shift onto becoming absolute, and then you try to say, yes, everything is my mind's projection. This is not true. This is not real. But someone hits you, someone is insulting you, someone takes your job away, you get inflicted with a disease. There is no absoluteness in that at that moment, isn't it? We're not capable of remaining with that. There's that tinge of sadness. There's that pang of jealousy and aggression within our own selves. There's the craving of desire. There's that anger of competitiveness, of your own insecurities, your own hope, and if not yours, your children, your husband, your sons and daughters, your family, your responsibility. So what happens is relative and absolute, we don't know where to go. Out of that, what happens is we then, on top of that, to make things much more complicated, then we have teachers coming and teach, Sangha members expecting you to do something. You're supposed to be always encouraging and inspiring and an example to the others. You read all those profound books. And the Western sort of culture of guilt, that further suppresses and makes things much more worse within one's own mind. So what happens is, intellectually, your mind cultivates a very deeper understanding of profound ideologies and views and different kinds of understandings. And your speech, your mind, your mental patterns, and your body, however, is unable to contain that. And so Buddhist world evolves as a world that speaks best on selfless compassion and does worst in many cases. We have that problem. We have that problem. We cannot say this is all negative, you know, because in some ways, people who meditate Buddhism, even from a very mistaken perspective, let's say, are often, with the world as it is today, I've always thought that they're always very, very good people. But again, we're not working on the optimistic side today. Let's look at a little bit on the negative side. And so to bring that, to sort of highlight on that, we find that as much time as we spend learning about compassion, how much are we able to actually do it in action? And often today I find that people who are not so spiritual and do not claim to be meditators are often kinder and less complicated. Likewise, people of other religion, other faith, Christianity, for example, are much more active in terms of involving themselves in acts of goodness or helping other people. Maybe the intention sometimes is more sort of the missionaries or to convert or so and so forth. That may be, but still, there's a lot of effort in generosity and giving. In comparison to that, Buddhists often are some of the most sort of self-absorbed people, very, very much into themselves. And ideas always about long-term planning, about after I am enlightened, then I'm going to be selfless, then no attachment and so forth. But currently at this moment in your life, never sharing, never caring, never gentle, never really patient. When that kind of a situation evolves and we look into what is the cause of it, then we often find it is this inability to really reconcile and look into one's own self and one's own potential and to actually have the courage of working from ground zero or from the very beginning. It's not necessary. For Buddhist meditators, it's very important to understand it's not necessary to have profound understandings in the beginning at all. None of us are capable of doing that. It's in the beginning, it's very important to start knowing one principle, and that is that to be able to understand Buddhism, which means Buddhism, or to understand Buddhist truth, means truth as it is. That's what it is. We do not have a God. We do not have a creator. We do not have a book to believe in. All that is the Buddhism is going to teach is Buddhist meditation leads you to understanding a truth that is neither my truth, neither your truth, but truth as it is. And that it is a sort of a path and guidelines and support and methods may be given to you based upon other people's experiences, which we refer to, whom we refer to as bodhisattvas and Buddhas, but ultimately the truth which is inherent must be discovered by you. That's what Buddhists talk about. So from that perspective, one has to know that when it is a path that leads to the realization of the truth, it cannot be achieved ever without it being beginning from the platform of honesty. If you cannot be honest, and if the path cannot be honesty, then it cannot lead to truth. Fabricating and fabricating, deliberating and deliberating, all of the different kinds of deliberations and fabrications that we pile upon are only going to make matters much more complicated than actually leading to the genuine sort of truth of one's own inherent nature. Therefore, in the beginning, in terms of the next four or five talks that are there, what I would like to do is to really work with Buddha's way of expounding the teachings, and that is relationship between intention and result. That's the main thing. For example, the title of the talk itself says Bodhicitta's relationship to four karmas. And four karmas, usually Shijie Wangra, we say in Tibetan, Shiva is pacifying. The first karma or first activity is called pacifying activity. Second is called enriching activity, Jeba. Third, in English, usually you say magnetizing, but we also may translate it as empowering. And the fourth is subjugating or wrathfulness, Trakbo. So four activities that we talked about. And it was interesting when I was looking at the title of the text, and I was also joking with Jigme, who's coordinating this visit, is about, you have to be very careful in how you want to really work with a certain topic. Buddhism is a vast enough topic that you can just take words from anywhere and make a semblance or connection in any kind of possible ways. But that's not the point over here. Bodhicitta, from this perspective, would be is the enlightened heart. Whatever is true, whatever is the genuine heart as it is, nature as is, which is inherent of one's own self. Four activities, or the four karmas as they are usually referred to, commonly these are four terms that are very connected to the Vajrayana practices. Within the secret mantrayana practices of creation stage, for example, we often talk about these four remarkable activities or actions that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas manifest. And a very flowery talk can be made about how we can exude pacifying energy and enriching energy and so on and so forth. But that would not be beneficial. That's good to listen to, but it's not beneficial for one's own self. Therefore, in terms of connecting this topic, I would say is much more helpful for you if you look at it from the perspective of potential, your own potential. What is it, the current potential that you have as a meditator? Potential of generosity. How much generosity can you really practice? Potential of love. How much can you actually generate love? Potential of patience. How much patience can you generate within your own self? When you look into your own self and you realize your potential, and you take time to really examine your potential and your intention at this moment, then it's a very good starting point of how to work with the teachings and the meditation. Take an example. For example, if you're saying, I'm going to meditate for half an hour just to gain some peace of mind, quietness of my own mind, some kind of pacification of my own mind, that itself is the pacifying karma. That itself is the peacefulness that is there. Much better than a heart and a mind in turmoil that goes out to pacify other things. Isn't it?